pull back and fundamentally reassess, you know, what is the United States subsidizing here? Is it in the interest of the United States?
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Security Dilemma, a podcast by the John Quincy Adams Society. I'm Patrick Carver Fox, joined by AJ Manuzzi as we have a conversation with Dr. John Hoffman, a policy analyst in defense and foreign policy at the Cato Institute. He holds a PhD in political science from George Mason, is part of the Middle East Policy Council's 40 Under 40, and writes about Middle East geopolitics in publications like Foreign Policy, The Washington Post, and The National Interest. He's joining us today to talk about Gaza and the politics of the Middle East. We'd recorded this yesterday. It's very fresh, so let's jump right into our conversation with John Hoffman. John Hoffman, welcome to Security Dilemma. To start off today, you wrote a popular piece in Foreign Policy arguing that Israel is a, quote, strategic liability to the United States. Can you walk us through your argument?
Sure. First, thank you both for having me on today. The crux of the article is really trying to zoom out and bring the U.S. relationship with Israel and, by extension, U.S. Middle East policy back to questions of first-order assumptions. You know, what is the United States getting from pouring all of this money, all of this weaponry, all these military assets into the region? And it kind of zooms in on the past 5 months, you know, of Israel's war in Gaza following the terrorist attack by Hamas on October 7th. Because the past 5 months have elucidated so comprehensively and so clearly the unidirectional manner or nature of this relationship. And, you know, it tries to bring this back to questions of what is the United States doing here?
In the piece, you assert that America's unconditional support for Israel's regional policies has, quote, fueled some of the worst actors in Israeli politics, encouraged ruinous policies, and generally done violence to the long-term interests of both countries. Could you explain in greater detail what you mean by that line of argument?
Sure. So what I mean here specifically by fueling some of the worst actors in Israeli politics is the United States has been effectively subsidizing Israeli policies. And this has occurred alongside a very hard shift to the right in Israeli politics. So what we're seeing is the United States providing cover and continuing to throw money towards, you know, the Netanyahus of the world, the Ben-Gaviers, the Smotriches. We're seeing these terrible policies being pursued, and we keep seeing Washington writing checks for them. And when I, you know, make this argument, what I'm saying is we are insulating Israel from the costs of these policies, which in the long term are unsustainable and counterproductive, I would say, not just to the United States, but to Israel as well. You know, what incentive does Israel face to change course when the most powerful state in the world refuses to condition its profound levels of political, economic, and military support, knowing that the United States will never hold them responsible, knowing that the checkbook will never close? This allows Israel to act with impunity and then directly implicates the United States in whatever policies they choose.
As of the date of recording, we're recording this at about 2 p.m. on March 26th, Netanyahu is still threatening an invasion of Rafah, but has yet to actually begin it. What can we expect from something like that? And are there any like precedents or comparisons that are helpful in kind of contextualizing this?
Sure. So I think we're standing at a critical juncture right now where the United States has, at the rhetorical level, said, oh, don't go into Rafah without a plan to protect civilians and stuff like that. But while at the same time, you know, approving these 100 arms sales since October 7th, while, you know, blocking the three UN resolutions, the one that did just pass, calls for an immediate ceasefire, you know, for the month of Ramadan, but, you know, that ends in 2 weeks and there's really no enforcement mechanism here. An invasion of Rafah, a ground invasion of Rafah, would be arguably the worst of what we've seen in the past 5 months. 1.5 million Palestinians are packed into the city. This is more than half the population of Gaza itself. You know, this would be, you know, most likely a bloodbath. And the administration, I think, hope some realize this. I think they see their numbers, you know, especially the uncommitted votes and things like that heading into November. I think they see the writing on the wall that They're angering a tremendous amount of their base. We've seen 32,000 Palestinians killed so far. I think if they push into Rafah, we're going to see that number rise considerably. I think, you know, this is a very much a put your money where your mouth is type of moment, and Biden is at the helm, and it's ultimately his responsibility to, to stand up for, you know, what U.S. interests are and the values that we claim to stand for.
Yeah, I'd love to talk a little bit more about the things that America can do to pressure Israel, because that is a bit of a debate, I think, within the realism and restraint circle. Vice President Harris stated 2 days ago that she would not, quote, rule out consequences for a Rafah offensive, but characterized such an offensive as a mistake. How is language like this being interpreted by Israel and also by regional actors like Egypt, Hamas, and other parties in this conflict?
So we've seen, you know, Harris being more critical at the rhetorical level. We've seen a kind of a shift in the Biden administration. You know, I refer to it as strategically leaking these reports of being frustrated with Netanyahu, so on and so forth. But empty rhetoric is going to accomplish nothing here. It's just empty rhetoric. I think Steve Walt had a really good piece the other week in Foreign Policy where he said, you know, the United States doesn't have as much leverage over Israel that it thinks it does, or that people often presume. And that's quite possibly the case. You know, the United States has shown both an unwillingness and in some ways an inability to leverage its special relationship with Israel. And that's why with this article, I'm trying to bring it back to what I often say, first order assumptions. Either use the leverage you claim this aid is providing you, you know, use it. Or recognize that aid without leverage is simply a blank check. Mm. And then ask, what are you doing? You know, if either use the leverage you claim to have, or that so many proponents of American military aid to Israel claim that, it gives us leverage. Okay, do it. And if it doesn't, then this should show that the whole aid for leverage argument is flawed. And if that's the case, then this we're writing are blank checks, and that's not good either. So, you know, either way here, you know, this is again a moment where, you know, a put your money where your mouth is type of moment. You know, show that this investment gives us the leverage that so many claim it does, and if it doesn't, then stop writing blank checks.
Is there a way for the Biden administration to attempt to use this leverage in a way that isn't essentially admitting 5 months of bad policymaking?
I don't know. You know, I think at some point they're going to have to realize that it's not just 5 months of bad policymaking. This is almost 8 decades of bad policymaking when it comes to the Middle East more generally. And I think the 100 arms sales that have been approved since October 7th, the $14 billion that was approved by the Senate in additional military aid to Israel, what all of these things signal is that there is no red line. You know, Biden, you know, talked about his ethereal red line when he was interviewed by MSNBC. And he said, we cannot have another 30,000 more Palestinians dead. But then immediately, like 2 breaths later, said the defense of Israel is still critical. So there is no red line. You know, so stop the hypocritical statements. Stop writing these blank checks and pull back and fundamentally reassess, you know, what is the United States subsidizing here? Is it in the interest of the United States? I've had a lot of conversations with staunch Israel supporters, and many admit, you know, this is not even in the best interests of Israel. It's clearly not in the best interests of the Palestinians. Many Israel supporters are starting to say, hold on, you know, what we're doing to our reputation, what we're doing by eliminating any prospects of a peaceful political solution to this, you know, you are digging a hole that you're not going to get out of.
Does this most recent passage of a ceasefire resolution through the UN Security Council mean anything significant? It seems like, you know, Israel has canceled this visit to the White House, and there's been a lot of very strong language about how, you know, like support cuts both ways. Is it a meaningful new precedent, or how should we be interpreting?
So I think, you know, on the one hand, it's good that the United States you know, let this pass. But on the other hand, you know, a lot of people, I think, have played this up much more than it actually is. You know, there is no, you know, enforcement mechanism here. You know, again, it's still really just displeasure at the rhetorical level. The United States was the one that scrapped from the resolution this phrasing of a temporary, I mean, of a permanent stop to the conflict. And as we speak, Gallant right now is in D.C. requesting a whole, you know, slew of weaponry and military hardware that if the United States goes ahead and just rubber stamps it, you know, then the whole charade, you know, at the UN is going to be just that. And you know, this is showing that, again, it is a put your money where your mouth is kind of moment. You cannot, even, you know, with the Security Council resolution, you cannot just talk about, you know, Biden. The greatest analogy that I'd like to use here is Biden and his team are starting to sound like somebody who wants to see the manager, like at a restaurant or something. Well, it's like, dude, you're in charge. So, you know, you're talking like you want to see, you know, talk to a manager here. You're the one that keeps writing these checks. It's your name on here. So, you know, again, you need to be serious and you need to recognize that rhetoric at this point will not work.
Just before we started recording, I came across some new polling via Twitter from, I believe it was the Israeli Democracy Institute, and it put Benjamin Netanyahu's approval rating at 28%. It found that 42% of Israelis believe that his rule is in jeopardy. How should American policymakers think about the role of Israeli domestic politics in the war?
So, you know, the role of Israeli domestic politics is, you know, a fascinating element of all of this. I don't know the extent to which the United States should fixate on that, because the United States should be, you know, those in Washington should be concerned primarily, first and foremost, with U.S. domestic policies. But I think they need to also, you know, look at the writing on the wall. Historic lows of approval for Netanyahu. Everything shows that if early elections were to be held, he would just get obliterated, and it would be Benny Gantz that would most likely, you know, be premier. I think what the United States is doing by continuing to fuel this war is also continuing to fuel Netanyahu's grasp on power, because, like I said, he seems to recognize that once this war is over, he's over. You know, the Israeli public is so fed up with Netanyahu for a multitude of reasons, not just, you know, October 7th in the past 5 months. But what we're doing here is, by continuing to fuel this, the United States is in effect subsidizing Netanyahu's grasp on power at the exact same time. So I think they also need to look at, you know, not, you know, have it be their number one priority, but also look at the domestic, is, you know, context within Israel that shows they are not happy with Netanyahu. Maybe continuing to write blank checks to Netanyahu isn't the best idea. You know, now who or what comes after Netanyahu might be, you know, just as problematic from a U.S. policy point of view. It might be worse. You know, we're not sure, but at the very least, what we're seeing now is more pressure against Netanyahu himself, you know, from people like Schumer and others. But again, absent any real concrete policy change, this will just remain rhetoric.
The Abraham Accords initiative, spearheaded initially by the Trump administration and embraced by the Biden administration, really is grounded in the perceived decline and salience of the Palestinian cause to the Arab Middle Eastern countries, as well as a dual kind of shared fear of Iran is the other factor. Through the pursuit of Israeli-Saudi normalization in exchange for security guarantees, Biden has even expanded this set of policies. But as for the underlying assumption of the declining salience of the Palestinian cause, shared fear of Iran, and economic aid for peace, how true do you think that assumption is? And just as importantly, you know, what is the appetite like on the ground for Arab publics versus Arab governments in the Palestinian cause?
No, of course. I think you know, this conflict as a whole has really shown the underlying failures of the Abraham Accords. The Abraham Accords, you know, and I've written about this a lot, are very much a top-down mechanism. These were an agreement between political elites. This wasn't, you know, some bottom-up normalization between Arab publics and the Israeli public. This is, you know, a political project, an inherently political project pursued by regional political elites and political elites in Washington. Now, the Accords and Biden's continued fixation on the Accords really this latter part, the continued fixation on the Accords, are really at the heart of, you know, what I would say is a failure of U.S. Middle East policy, is this inability to break with policies that have clearly not produced stability, have clearly not advanced U.S. interests. And we see Biden continuing to cling for, you know, this Saudi-Israel deal that, according to him and Brett McGurk, will solve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, will bring peace to the Middle East, cure AIDS, solve world hunger, and do everything else. But, you know, this is fantasy. This is more maneuvering by the United States to and regional elites to try and preserve the overall political, economic, and military status quo in the region. And that's what was at the heart of the Accords to begin with, and this is just simply an extension of that.
In describing the Abraham Accords as top-down, or another phrase I heard you use was the formalization of a coercive political and economic security order designed to maintain the status quo, what would the alternative be? What is a bottom-up or more natural solution going to end up looking like? If America isn't thumbing the scale of Middle Eastern power politics, What's gonna happen?
So that's a really, really good question, and I think it first starts with the United States acknowledging that we don't, you know, Washington doesn't have all the answers here. You know, clearly our policies aren't really helping towards peace and towards stability and the sort. But in terms of what actual normalization would look like, is first a recognition that you cannot sidestep the Palestinian issue. You cannot sidestep Arab publics. You cannot do this. This is a recipe for disaster. In terms of sidestepping the future of the Palestinian people, this is a foolish strategy. You know, the past 5 months should demonstrate that pretty clearly. But you can't separate this from the broader illiberal and unstable regional order across the Middle East more generally. The issue of Palestine remains intimately tethered to the broader aspirations of the Arab masses for political, economic, and social freedom. And these things can't be sidelined through top-down frameworks like the Abraham Accords. So what this is going to take is foundational political, economic, and social change. Now, whether the United States is the one equipped to do that is, you know, people have debated. But the way that I see it is by subsidizing and fueling some of the worst actors across the region, and by, you know, leading with an overly militarized approach to the region, beginning to address the political, economic, and social problems of the Middle East is impossible so long as you're charging in at the point of a gun, trying to, you know, politically engineer things that you think are in your favor.
If America stops providing military aid to regimes in Arab countries, what do you think will start happening? Do you think a natural order will be preserved? Do you think actors like China or Russia will get more involved? What actually are the next steps if America withdraws military aid?
So if America were to withdraw military aid, I think, you know, going back to the what you mentioned about the uprisings should have really been a clear wake-up call for the United States that this order is artificial. This is built upon exclusion, repressive politics, and security guarantees from the world's preeminent superpower. So in the 13 years since the uprisings, the root causes in the grievances that led to the uprisings are profoundly worse today than they were in 2011. So, you know, it's not a matter of, are there going to be another Arab uprisings? It's a matter of, when does this house of cards, you know, collapse again, and we see what we saw in 2011. In my analysis, you know, I always try to reorient these discussions towards what actually constitutes regional stability and security. Viewing both of these through the lens of U.S. primacy, U.S. global primacy more generally, I argue has been detrimental for the Middle East and has been detrimental for American interests. There needs to be a renewed focus on actual human security in the Middle East. And when I always get asked the question, well, if the United States stops, you know, sending weaponry, curtails its military presence in the region, what do we do about China? What do we do about Russia? And I've written a lot about this, saying neither Russia nor China have the capability or really the desire to assert a hegemonic presence in the Middle East akin to what the United States has for decades. They are well aware of the disasters that they've seen the United States, you know, get itself into. They're not keen to repeat those. And also, they are far more concerned with their own respective theaters. Russia is, you know, bogged down now in Ukraine. That will, you know, the idea that it's now going to, you know, roll tanks into the Middle East is pretty fanciful. But same with China. You know, any diversion of military assets or anything like that from the Asia Pacific is going to immediately give the United States the upper hand in the Asia Pacific. And China just does not want to do this. China does not want to devote considerable military and security resources to the Middle East when it's so concerned with its own neighborhood. And domestically, remember, you know, the Chinese economy isn't doing too great right now. And there's also a lot of domestic opposition within China towards the CCP. So by the very nature of its government, it has to devote considerable resources to just preserving the status quo internally.
I want to turn back to Gaza just for a second. In his State of the Union address, President Biden announced a plan to build a temporary floating pier off the coast of Gaza to allow ships to sail up and deliver humanitarian aid. What do you make of this increasingly, you know, Rube Goldbergian proposal? And what, if anything, does it say about the state of American policy?
Look, so I think the pier is just the perfect encapsulation of what the hell are we doing? You know, to provide context for the pier, the situation in Gaza is so bad that the United States, alongside some other countries, are airlifting aid into the strip, and the United States deployed 1,000 troops to build a pier off the shore of Gaza in order to break a siege that its supposed ally, using U.S. weapons, refuses to lift. This makes no sense given the state that Gaza is currently in right now. Even bringing in this aid, this is like bringing a Band-Aid to a gunshot wound. You know, Gaza has been decimated. The scale of the destruction that we've seen has been historic. U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin recently claimed that 25,000 women and children alone have been killed as a result of the war in Gaza. So, you know, 5 months in, building this pier, you know, while Biden insists that it's not quote unquote boots on the ground. Okay, I guess you can call it boots on the boat or whatever. But, you know, this is just, you know, it would be comical if it wasn't so sad at the same time.
The American deployment of an offshore presence to deter further intervention seems to have a lot to do with Lebanese Hezbollah and the threats to Israel's north. Earlier before the recording, there were some missiles fired or airstrikes from Israel deeper into Lebanon than I believe they've been doing so far in this conflict, or at least something close to that. What role has Hezbollah played in this conflict, and what role has America played in deterring that?
Yeah, so, you know, the regional ramifications of all of this, whether it be the ongoing, you mentioned this morning, but it happens almost every day, you know, the ongoing skirmishes between Hezbollah in the north and Lebanon and Israel. We've seen a tremendous uptick in attack on U.S. troops in Iraq and Syria, 170 attacks, I believe, since October 7th. Those have calmed for now. I don't think there have been many attacks since, I think it was February 9th. So they have calmed for now. But, you know, the three troops that were killed at Tower 22 in Jordan, we also have the continued continuing escalation with the Houthis, you know, and their targeting of commercial shipping throughout the Red Sea and the Bab el-Mandeb Strait. So we see all these different flashpoints. And the most dangerous one, I would argue, is the one you mentioned between Hezbollah and Israel. But we see all these different flashpoints, and we see that the United States is responding with its old playbook. It's throwing money and military assets and weapons at the region. It's striking these groups back in these tit-for-tat exchanges. This is problematic because deterrence has clearly failed in the Middle East. America's presence in these strikes and these tit-for-tat exchanges are not deterring further actions by these groups, and what it risks is not only the lives of U.S. service members in places like Iraq and Syria, they're just there as sitting ducks. These are all dangerous tripwires for a war with Iran. Though these attacks have lessened in the past several weeks, if Israel decides to push into Rafah, it should be expected that these attacks will likely, start back up. And, it's only a matter of time until we wake up to a headline that says 20 U.S. troops killed and, a strike on X base. The prospects of this escalating into a broader regional conflict are very real. And when you mentioned about Lebanon and Hezbollah, Israel has struck as far as Baalbek in Lebanon, which it hasn't done since 2006 in the war with Hezbollah. Hezbollah is launching hundreds of missiles into Israel. So this still has the potential of spiraling into something that extends well beyond Gaza, extends well beyond the Middle East. So the United States needs to be aware of this and, needs to be aware that pouring more fuel on the fire is not a good idea.
Speaking of the attacks in the Red Sea, China has a stake in Red Sea shipping and maintaining the free flow of oil, of course. And yet, China has been conspicuously quiet about using its own leverage to address the issue of the Houthis and the attacks in the Red Sea. For example, the Houthis have actually let Russian and Chinese vessels flow through while attacking other vessels. So I guess my question is, could you talk a little bit more about the stake that China has in the Middle East, why it's limited, as you've outlined earlier, and how the United States can incentivize more responsible behavior in the Middle East overall and do burden shifting?
Sure. So, I think the example of the Houthis and the Red Sea and the Bab el-Mandeb crisis, if you will, I think this really encapsulates well how the United States is the one kind of fronting the bill for, protecting these vessels going through this area when it's countries like China or Russia or, really countries all around the world that have a vested interest in making sure that these vessels go through. But it's the United States that ends up paying the bill here, or more specifically, the American taxpayer. But by being the actor so ready to jump to the gun and stuff like that, the United States, by its very nature, is forcing other actors to take a lesser role. The United States immediately jumped on this and started a tit-for-tat military exchange with the Houthis, which is still ongoing. And for an actor like China, they're sitting back and they're saying, well, we're not going to get involved in this. The United States is the one, who is, knee-deep in this situation. When China's biggest concern when it comes to the Middle East is the free flow of oil, because the United States, for example, Saudi Arabia, we get 7% of our oil from. China gets 50% of its oil from the Gulf. So China has a vested interest here in making sure that these vessels get through, so on and so forth. And if the United States were to take a more hands-off approach, this would probably, in many cases, force other actors like China to step in and say, well, hey, this is against our interests as well. You can't be doing these types of things. The United States has, upheld this security umbrella in the region, which has come at a tremendous cost, which hasn't produced stability in the region, but it has allowed opportunistic actors like China and Russia to advance their interests at very low costs, knowing that it's the United States that the one who is upholding this umbrella.
I'd love to talk a little bit about the trajectory of American relationships with some of the other major Middle Eastern parties. Specifically Egypt. Egypt has been in the news a lot lately. They literally border Rafah, where this potential Israeli offensive would begin. But they aren't in the news for that reason. They're in the news because they've had a very interesting relationship with Senator Bob Menendez. Over the sort of trajectory of the post-Arab Spring period with the coalition government that turned eventually into el-Sisi's regime, what is the state of Egyptian-American relations and what's on the horizon with it? What's changing? What can we expect?
The heart of the U.S.-Egypt relationship is the $1.1 or $1.3 billion that the United States continues to provide Egypt to maintain its relations with Israel. This is despite the fact that Israel and Egypt are strategically aligned. Abdel Fattah el-Sisi and Benjamin Netanyahu or whoever, you know, may be taking his place, they are strategically aligned on a number of issues. Egypt is not about to roll tanks into Israel, but the United States continues to pay the bill thinking otherwise. Over the past 10 years, since Abdel Fattah el-Sisi has come to power in Egypt, we have seen an unprecedented and, you know, massive crackdown on all elements of Egyptian society. We have seen the United States actively, you know, thwarting in 2011 and 2012 and in 2013 efforts to stop this, you know, really hard shift towards military rule within Egypt. And, you know, Shadi Hamid has written a great book called, I think it was The Problems of Democracy. And he has a lot of interviews with Obama admin officials, you know, who really, you know, played a direct role in kind of reversing the democratic gains that were achieved in Egypt earlier on. And then, of course, you know, Mohamed Morsi was not a good actor. So things became complicated quickly. But in the past 10 years, what we've seen in Egypt, which is the Arab world's most populous country, is again another country that is on the brink. You know, they are on the I have many colleagues in Egypt, and we openly talk, you know, that the anger throughout the streets towards Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, towards the military, particularly over the economic situation in Egypt, are incredibly profound. And there are whispers of, you know, people taking back to the streets. If that were to happen, it's a question of how would the United States react? How it reacted to the Arab uprisings the first time around by just emphatically, you know, embracing counter-revolutionary actors and trying to preserve this status quo clearly didn't work. So if this were to happen again, I think we would have to return to a different conceptualization of what constitutes real security and real stability within the region. And in a place like Egypt, the Arab world's most populous country, how you approach that situation is going to have widespread repercussions for the entire region.
The other country that Israel fought, you know, a series of wars in the 40s through the 70s was Syria, which had a very different path out of the Arab Spring than Egypt. How would you describe the state of normalization with the Assad regime, or generally what's been happening between America and its Syria policy, given that we still have troops there?
Yeah, so I think the heart of the Syria policy is the 900 or so U.S. troops that are still stationed in Syria. You know, they're stationed there for, you know, quote unquote, counter ISIS operations, but really, in actuality, you know, ISIS has been decimated. These troops are there, you know, really because people in Washington believe that this, you know, deters Iran somehow from acting within Syria or acting within Iraq, you know, but this is just not the case. Syria is, you know, still incredibly fragmented right now. Bashar al-Assad is by no means a good ruler. He is a ruthless autocrat. He is, you know, has the bloods of hundreds of thousands on his hands. But the United States believing that keeping 900 or so U.S. troops in Syria is somehow a good idea instead of them just representing, again, sitting ducks and a dangerous tripwire for war with Iran is really unfathomable. So I think there has to be a, when it comes to Syria in particular, a stepping back and looking at what has our overly militarized approach accomplished? What is our current troop presence in Syria accomplishing? And, you know, this should be part of a broader rethinking of U.S. military policy in the Middle East.
On the campaign trail, President Biden, to great aplomb in the Democratic primary, pledged to make Saudi Arabia a pariah, his words. And he also pledged no more blank checks, also his words, for Egypt's el-Sisi on the grounds of human rights, on the grounds of these partners' willingness to defy U.S. interests when they conflict with their own. Why do you think the administration has departed from this mission and instead has entirely, you know, embraced Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, the fist bump and the Saudi normalization deal? Why do you think the administration has wholeheartedly pivoted to a bear hug strategy with these governments?
Well, first, I think, you know, the rhetoric on the campaign trail was just rhetoric for the sake of sounding good and trying to win votes. I don't think he actually, you know, him or anybody on his team actually had a intention of fundamentally reorienting U.S. Middle East policy. I think what really led so emphatically to this, you know, from pariah to going over there and doing a fist bump, you know, in Saudi Arabia in particular, was the war in Ukraine. You know, this idea that Saudi Arabia somehow, you know, especially, you know, as oil prices were rising, the idea that Saudi Arabia will, you know, play with the pumps according to U.S. interests if the United States continues to dangle goodies in front of Mohammed bin Salman, so on and so forth. But this all proved out to be wrong. You know, the Saudi oil policy is dictated by Saudi interests, and the cost of oil is dictated by international supply and demand. What led to this emphatic shift was, I think, this broader Cold War 2.0 framing within Washington that really took over after the war in Ukraine, that, you know, any notion of the United States stepping back and playing a lesser role anywhere, whether it be the Middle East, in Europe, in the Asia Pacific, will ultimately result in either Moscow or Beijing immediately rushing in to fill that void. I think that, at the end of the day, is what has carried the Biden administration's approach to actors like Mohammed bin Salman and his buddying up with them and things like that. I think, at the end of the day, it's just a part of this broader framing by those such as, you know, Brett McGurk, Antony Blinken, Jake Sullivan, that views this zero-sum competition with Russia and China as applying to every single context around the world. And I think that's why you saw such an emphatic shift away from his campaign rhetoric, not just because he didn't really intend on doing it to begin with, but I think he – you know, Biden has always placed alliances and these relationships at the very center of his foreign policy. So I think in Biden and team's mind, actors like Mohammed bin Salman and strong-handed actors in the Middle East are the best way to uphold American interests in the region. I would argue the opposite. But, you know, I think that's where they're coming from is they might be nefarious actors, but these relationships are necessary to combat, you know, Moscow, Beijing, et cetera.
Part of the impetus for JQAS is the idea that personnel is policy. And you just kind of hinted at that right there. At a time when there's such widespread disaffection, even before October 7th, even before the election of Joe Biden, with U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East, why do you think that the political forces that brought Joe Biden to power were unwilling to change and actually put some of these folks in power rather than relying on people like Brett McGurk, like, you know, Tony Blinken, who was Joe Biden's advisor during the Iraq War? You know, why was that latent energy, do you think, absent in the policy considerations that the White House is actually, you know, undergoing?
No, and I would agree with you, the notion of personnel is policy. And I think it's because they came into the administration having no intention whatsoever to change course fundamentally from decades of policies that Biden himself has supported. You know, Biden was a big proponent of the 2003 war in Iraq. You know, Biden has regularly been on the wrong side of history on a number of foreign policy issues. So him and those around him assembled a team based on upholding this, you know, liberal international order, this rules-based international order that isn't really liberal, isn't really rules-based. It's a generational issue as well at the end of the day. You know, when you have the Brett McGurks, when you have the Anthony Blinkens, when you have the Jake Sullivans, when you have the Joe Bidens, and of course the same, you know, it's the same on the right as well. You have the same people doing the same jobs, yet failing over and over and over. It's funny, in this field, it seems, or in this world, it seems like the only two people that can be consistently wrong and keep their jobs are foreign policy experts and weathermen, because they're just consistently wrong, yet they're rolled over into every administration, and they continue to harp on the exact same lines. Something that people like the three of us, you know, sitting here who are younger, you know, I'm 28, you know, we came up in the post 9/11 era. You know, we saw, you know, the you know, on TV every night, you know, the disastrous effects of U.S. Foreign policy. And I think as people, you know, younger people, you know, start coming into positions of authority and things like that, I think that is ultimately when we will see change, because it seems like the old guard, if you will, is so reluctant to try anything different.
Speaking of some of the new and young actors getting into U.S. foreign policy, we have millennial rock stars like Prince Mohammed bin Salman making some big moves. I'm curious, because The Gulf Cooperation Council and the Gulf monarchies are such a unique set of actors on the world stage. You know, from the line that like new city they want to make to investing directly in Palestine or otherwise, you know, GCC money being used to create a humanitarian solution, Gulf money seems to be interpreted as a bit of a deus ex machina for Middle Eastern problems. How should American realists be interpreting this sort of money? Like, what are the realist interests of the Gulf in, you know, even entertaining these ideas? And what should America want out of them?
Sure. So, you know, the explosion of Gulf money abroad is, you know, multifaceted. So at one, on one hand, it is to a large extent whitewashing. You know, the Mohammed bin Salman, Mohammed bin Zayed, they're trying to assert the Gulf, Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, to the forefront of the Middle East geopolitical, the Middle East economic, and the Middle East political landscapes. So, you know, there's very much a notion of whitewashing here. There's a notion of trying to assert one geopolitically. There's also the economic angle to this too. You know, Mohammed bin Salman, you know, in particular, is overseeing this big nationalist project, you know, this reorientation of Saudi Arabia towards this type of hyper-nationalism. And he needs money to do this. And he needs these grand projects to pay off. And that's why you see, you know, Saudi Arabia pouring money into Gulf or the UFC or different, you know, celebrities coming and performing in Saudi Arabia that you would, you know, think it would be impossible 20 years ago. But at the same time that these certain social reforms are taking place, you know, women are allowed to drive, travel alone, things like that, we've seen the political, economic, and social realities within Saudi Arabia come under the authority of one individual in a truly unprecedented manner. Mohammed bin Salman has amassed more power within Saudi Arabia than any individual in the history of the modern Saudi state. But this cult of personality, this aura that they're constructing around themselves when it comes to politics, when it comes to regional politics and peacemaking, or when it comes to, you know, economics, global sports, and things like that, this is all part of a broader restructuring that is not only perceived as imperative for the domestic situation in countries like Saudi Arabia and the UAE, but also their foreign relations. You know, they want to remain at the forefront of the Middle East geostrategic landscape, which means being tapped into Washington, which means continuing to have the United States front the bill for their security, which means also cozying up to Israel because the attention that Israel commands on both sides of the political aisle. So Saudi Arabia in particular, you know, is trying to use this cozying up with Israel and the possible normalization of relations, and that might come with the rebuilding of Gaza or whatever, to extract what is the ultimate concession from the United States, which is a security guarantee. And, you know, most of my work was focusing on that leading up to October 7th. But the fact that that is being packaged together now as a way to solve this entire thing is just a continuation of decades of refusing to recognize that you cannot sideline the Palestinian issue. You cannot sideline Arab public opinion. And if you want to grant the ultimate concession that the United States can grant upon a foreign nation to Mohammed bin Salman, then, you know, I have a different story to sell you here. This is a horrible idea.
Some have phrased Gulf monarchies promoting a moderate Islam, or, you know, some other form of a more moderate Western-friendly version of Arab politics, which, you know, I suppose implies an alternative to the model offered by the Islamic Republic of Iran. What's going on with this sort of Iranian-Arab soft power competition, and can we even really call it that?
So the moderate Islam question is fascinating, and I have a book on it coming out this year. The moderate Islam, the quote-unquote moderate Islam that's being promoted by, you know, Mohammed bin Salman, Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, Mohammed bin Zayed, is statist Islam. This is regime-controlled Islam, an Islam that is controlled in 100% by the state. There is no Islam outside of what the state says it is. So in many ways, it's being promoted as an alternative to Iran's, you know, promotion of Islam and things like that. But in many ways, it's very similar because it's very statist. It's very regimeist. It's controlled by the regime. This notion of moderate Islam plays on this broader dichotomy that emerged after 9/11, you know, this good Muslim, bad Muslim dichotomy that exploits a lot of misunderstandings surrounding Islam, a lot of racism that's still pretty pervasive within DC. And the moderate Islam that is being packaged to the West and these, you know, massive crackdowns on quote unquote extremists and things like that are just regular everyday authoritarian politics, but now they're being packaged as, you know, a way for religious tolerance and so on and so forth. And I say this myself as a member of the Muslim community, that this is not lost upon Muslims, you know, around the world, that what they're doing is based on politics, not piety.
I want to conclude with just a big picture question that we've been tiptoeing around this whole time. In your view, what are America's true national interests in the Middle East, and what do we actually need to do to achieve them?
Sure. So, you know, American interests in the Middle East should boil down to the safety and prosperity of the American people and upholding the values that we claim to stand for. So within that includes, you know, the flow of oil from the Middle East that is in our national interest, is in the national interest of every country in the world. What's also in the interest of the United States is making sure that terrorist groups from the region, you know, aren't able to attack the United States or don't have a reason to come after the United States. And then the final one is preventing the emergence of a regional hegemon, somebody from rolling in, whether it be a state within the region, you know, people typically point at Iran, or whether it be a state from outside the region, people typically point to China, preventing any state from rolling in and conquering the region. None of these three things, the maintaining the flow of oil, the counterterrorism, or the regional hegemon, whether that be a regional actor or, you know, this new great power competition framing, none of this requires the expansive U.S. presence that is there right now. None of this requires the policies that we are pursuing. And as I've argued, you know, to the point that I'm blue in the face, all of these areas are actually undermined by our overly militarized approach. They fuel the grievances that lead to unrest and terrorism. They fuel the actions by different state actors that could disrupt the flow of oil and so on and so forth. it leads to our disastrous policies lead to opportunities for actors like Russia and China to exploit our failures to move in and sweep up very opportunistic gains. So our interests in the region are very limited. I would say they're very easy to accomplish. And at a time when the United States is $33 trillion in debt, $2 trillion a year deficits, increasingly involved in Ukraine, tensions heightening surrounding China and Taiwan, the Middle East ranks pretty low on the list of the show facing the United States. So, you know, and it should be approached accordingly. But it takes on this outsized role, this outsized presence in our policy discussions, which is ultimately unfortunate.
John Hoffman, thank you so much for coming on Security Dilemma.
No, thank you both for having me.
Security Dilemma is a podcast by the John Quincy Adams Society. To learn more about our programs, visit our website at jqas.org. Remember to rate and review on your podcast app and join us every Tuesday for new episodes of Security Dilemma.